You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow, Brandon
Sanderson, Robin Mobb,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Elaine Shannon.
The Renegade Star Series, books 1 through 3 by J.N. Chaney. Jace Hughes is a renegade. That means taking almost any job that comes his way, no matter the situation. So long as he can keep his ship floating, he's free to live the life he wants. But that all changes when he meets Abigail Pryor, a nun looking for safe passage out of the system. Too bad there's something off about the cargo she's carrying. Jace knows he shouldn't ask too many questions, but when odd sounds start coming from inside the large metal box, he can't help but check it out. Big mistake. The Renegade Star box set includes the first three books in the series, 900 plus pages, 300 five-star reviews and counting. Find out why people are so intrigued by this thrilling science fiction epic. You won't believe the twists and turns this series takes, or the secrets that get revealed. The Renegade Star Series by J.N. Chaney. I'd also like to tell you about my friend Crystal Pico Watanabe of Pico's House. The Pico's House website now has a new look. Visit Crystal and her team of eight people who help her provide services to fiction authors. Crystal's full slate of services now include beta reading, manuscript critique, developmental editing, line editing, copy editing, and proofreading. Authors, you can also inquire about putting your books in her Book Lovers Box, which is a monthly digital subscription box with a different theme each month. This is free for authors for a limited time. PicosHouse.com for all your book publishing needs. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Elaine Shannon on the show with us today. I got Elaine's new book, Hunting LaRue, a couple of weeks ago or so when we're recording this, and I posted a picture on Instagram and on Facebook, and lots of folks were intrigued by the story, and I'll tell you what, as I dug in, I went way down the rabbit hole on the story. So I'm excited to have you on the show today. Elaine, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, it is a rabbit hole. Once you get into it, you think, well, you know, I'll just do a few hours more and then come out a week later.
Exactly. That's exactly what this book has done. And I can't wait to dig all into it. But before we do, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, gosh. I was a little kid in Gainesville, Georgia. And I was a small kid for my size because I was younger than most of them. And I used to go hide in the library. It was quiet, and there was a little stool, and I could sit way in the back, and I could read anything I wanted to. I kept doing it, and as I got older and older, when I got to be a teenager, I discovered I wanted to read Ernest Hemingway, and they wouldn't let kids check out Ernest Hemingway. I'm not sure. Sex? Violence? Bad language?
All of the above.
But I could still sit on that little stool, and I could still read all of it. When you tell a kid something, you can't do something, then the kid wants to do it like double time, and that was me.
That's so. What were the? I guess were you an avid reader at that point?
I read everything. I read far beyond my grade level, and
right.
You know, I was in public school in Georgia, which was I had wonderful teachers, but the regular reading was somewhat limited, and I wanted more, which is why that stool in the library was very important to me.
Right.
And my English teachers.
It's such a crazy thing that we put a damper on kids' curiosity, and this and I understand there's lots of stuff that goes into those decisions, and you know, I'm sure they don't take those decisions lightly, but when you have a kid that is just voracious and obviously has, you know, a larger window on the world, if you will, I think we need to encourage that.
Yes, and my parents did, and my parents encouraged something else, which was nonconformity. My father fought in World War II, and when he got back to the little town where he'd set up his optometric practice, he wasn't about to conform to what a bunch of anybody did, and he thought he was living on borrowed time. Every day that he was alive, and he loved to laugh and have a good time. So did my mother, often not in conformity with the local folks. So he read voraciously, so did I, and he encouraged that.
That's fantastic. Good for him. At what point, Elaine, were you bitten by the writing bug? Did you know that this was something that you wanted to pursue?
Well, I was a teenager and a child during a tumultuous time in the South. The editor of the Gainesville paper, whose name was Sylvan Meyer, would become quite famous for standing up for civil rights and for the rights of everyone who is oppressed. I met his in-laws. They had been in the camps. They were Jewish. They had tattoos from Auschwitz, Belsen, places like that. We talked a lot about what had happened in World War II. I was privileged to know people who had seen the worst in mankind and also the best. Of course, I wanted to write about that, and I could see what was going on around me in the South. I was also privileged to come up in a town that was not violent and didn't accept the worst kind of excesses of the Klan, but it was nearby. It was all around. One time my husband asked my father what had changed in the South. This was back in the 80s, I guess, and my father said, "The terror is gone." Well, it wasn't quite gone, but it had abated from the 50s and 60s when there was a Klan around. There was Klan in the 30s. He remembered when he was a kid the Klan coming into his church in Atlanta, all in robes and pointy hats, and his father grabbed him and his mother and said, "We're not putting up with this," and marched out of the church. The preacher came to see him and said, "You shouldn't have done that, because they'll come after you," and he said, "Let them try."
Right.
and they didn't. They were Klan is bullies.
Right.
I mean, we've always lived in the South with the duality of human nature. We've always lived with hate. We've lived with guilt. We've lived with recriminations, but we have also lived with great joy and discovery. We know the complexity of life and the darkness. And I've seen it. I saw it all quite young, and I wanted to write about all of that.
Well, I remember it was sometime in the mid-80s. I was a teenager. I was born in 71, so I was probably 14 or 15 maybe, and the Klan had gotten a parade permit, and they marched through the middle of our town with there were about 20 of them, I guess, and the thing that I still think back on now is that the people standing on the side way outnumbered the people marching, and for the most part were yelling derogatory things toward the Klan. And I think there's something about allowing people to be idiots in public and ridiculing them and shining light on that darkness that has a tendency to change minds and things. And I think, journalists have the same power to shine a light on something that just keeps in the dark.
That's right. People tend to stereotype us Southerners. I don't like it, you don't like it, but we know that it's happened and it's happened all our lives.
Right.
On the other hand, we have profited from that by a greater wisdom. I remember in my hometown, the Klan announced plans to have a float in the Christmas parade, and it was going to be called I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas.
Oh, my
Very
gosh.
Very funny. So the city fathers canceled the whole parade rather than allow those folks to be in it. Yeah, they made a different decision than the people in your hometown did, but people just didn't want them displaying themselves that way.
Right. And I understand both sides. I mean, I really do. But there's just something about shining the light and taking a stand against it that I think is a more powerful response.
Well, so, we can do both.
Yeah, we can do both. That's right. What were some of the first things that you started writing about?
Well, let's see. I started working for the newspaper when I was in high school, and I wrote about the goings-on at the local high school. And I also was on the high school paper. I went to college in Nashville at Vanderbilt, worked a little bit on the paper there. Got a job when I was still in college at the Nashville Tennessean, which was a great newspaper and still is. But it was John Siegenthaler was a legendary editor at that time, and he hired me to do the youth page. Well, that wasn't the most auspicious beginning, but I made a lot out of it, and I got my foot in the door. And my advice to young people starting out is get your foot in the door. No matter what, you can sweep, you can carry copy, you can carry coffee, you can do whatever it takes to get there. Once they get you get there and they like you, you're in, and they'd rather hire somebody they know than somebody they don't. If they don't like you, then well, you better move on.
Right. You've had an amazing journalistic career covering some amazing stories and writing for some of the great papers and magazines. How did you start getting involved in the type of journalism that you're famous for?
Well, I'm famous for covering what Rita Braver, my friend, calls the scum of the earth beat. And it's true. Mel Elfin, the great bureau chief of the Newsweek, assigned me to that beat in the first job I had at Newsweek, and well, first job out of the Tennessean I had. He thought that for some reason I could solve hard problems. He thought my background in Tennessee would be useful. That was 77, 78, and there I was covering the FBI. They'd never seen a woman reporter. They'd barely seen a woman agent. They didn't know what to do with women. But that was okay, because once they got used to me and they realized I was going to be fair and honest, they started talking to me. What I wanted to talk about was not what Hoover had done, because we'd all covered that plenty, and they were really sick of that. I wanted to talk about organized crime. I wanted to talk about terrorism and other things that the FBI was into right that minute, white-collar crime. I did a whole lot of stories about all of those different aspects of the modern FBI, and they accepted me. They liked what I was doing, because I was talking about them, not the past, although I did write about the past, too. I also started covering DEA. Particularly starting in 1979, when Miami was getting shot up by what the people they call the cocaine cowboys. These were Colombians and Cubans who were having a war right there on the streets of Miami at the dawn of the cocaine trade. I went down there. It was a pretty rough time. I met an awful lot of agents, and I got to know them and their stories. They were embattled. Nobody much liked them. People thought that marijuana was fine and cocaine was fine, really. People didn't think it was addictive in those days. I got to know them and their stories. Kept going. I went to Colombia, spent time in Mexico. In 1985, I went down to Colombia to write about the society that was under siege from the Colombian cartel. That led to a cover on Pablo Escobar, but while I was while I was writing it, something terrible happened. A DEA agent named Kiki Camarena was murdered in Mexico. At first, everybody thought, at least everybody in Washington thought, it was just a hit by the cartel, which would be sad, but it happens. But I got a call from the head of DEA, Bud Mullen, who said, "You got to come over. this isn't about the cartel, this is about the government. He and Jack Lalonde, who was his number two, they were both out of the FBI, but they were running DEA, had tried to find the agent's body or wherever he was being held, and they were being stiffed by important elements of the government, and our government wasn't much help. They thought there was a much bigger conspiracy than what could be seen. They started telling me about it. I started writing stories about all of the lies that were being told, and you could show what lies they were. These were sensational stories. The Mexican government ended up producing the body in a place where it obviously had not been buried originally. The soil tests could show that. The scandal became bigger and bigger, and I wrote a book about it called Desperados. This became very famous, as particularly among police, drug agents, all kinds of law enforcement agents, because it talked about all the corruption in Mexico, which we now take as for granted, but back then was covered up. Our government had covered up as well as the Mexican government, because our government wanted smooth trade relations. As an agent said to me recently, Kiki Camarena was like Jesus Christ. He died for all our sins.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a bit blasphemous, probably, and I'm a Baptist, but I understand what he meant. He meant that the death showed the ugliness and also the power of law enforcement, that it showed the ugliness of drug corruption and the power to do good that was potential, was waiting. Things started changing then. Things in the United States changed a lot. People were up in arms about it. That really hadn't changed. It got even bigger when Michael Mann made a miniseries out of Desperados called Drug Wars and showed the world all the corruption that had killed Kiki Camarena. He won an Emmy for that, and we became friends, which is why we're talking right now.
That's such a fantastic story, and you know, I think a lot of our eyes are opened to the reality of what how big these problems are, and I think when we think about organized crime, you know, maybe you think about a TV show like The Sopranos or something like that, and the reality is that these things are enormous and kind of have tentacles everywhere. When you as the writer start digging into this and really discovering how big and in-depth this is, that has to kind of be frightening a little bit, isn't it?
It is, but what is true always is organized crime, no matter where you're talking about, in the United States, Russia, Mexico, Thailand, organized crime cannot exist for long without the complicity of people in the government. Organized crime needs the state, needs the oxygen of the state to thrive. People who are in governments know this. There are some decent people all over the world, and there's others that enable organized crime. We have to have a clarity of vision and not expect organized crime to be this diabolical other that's in some place we can't see. We can see it all around. We can see it today on our streets. We can see it in the streets of other countries, and we have to see it for what it is.
When you start discovering a story like that one of Paul LaRue, it almost seems like from what you knew earlier, the stakes had changed. This is much bigger. This is new technology introduced into the organized crime. What was your first experience with this story?
This story is very complicated, but at the end, it's about what I just said: organized crime and the power of governments to protect it and enable it. I had been in Afghanistan. I wanted to write about the heroin trade and how it finances both sides of the war, all sides of the war, because there are many factions. As you've probably read, Afghanistan grows maybe 80-90% of the world's opium poppy. That is converted to heroin. That money from the heroin sales finances the Taliban almost exclusively. The Taliban doesn't have any other source of income except for the occasional kidnapping. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. But the warlords who are nominally on the U.S. side, they also, some of them profit from the opium trade, because there's really only one industry in Afghanistan. Well, two. One was foreign aid. U.S. brought in reconstruction aid, and you could see that siphoning right out the back door, flying that afternoon to banking havens in Dubai and China. The other big industry was heroin. I was there writing about that and hoping to get a book published. I'm still working on that. Because I got kind of sidetracked, I came out. I was talking to an agent I met there, and he said, I just met the most remarkable man, the most remarkable criminal. He's absolutely brilliant. He's very tech savvy, unlike the guys in Afghanistan. He's all over the world. I said, well, tell me more about him. Well, I can't tell you much, but we've just arrested him, and he is now flipped, and he's helping us bring in other criminals. Well, I did some poking, and I discovered that his name was Paul LaRue. He was indeed a tech innovator in his first career, which started when he was about 20 years old. He had been in a cybersecurity company that was inventing stronger cybersecurity for laptops back in the dawn of the cybersecurity industry. He could have gotten pretty rich doing that, because everybody needs security, particularly business people who travel, because foreign services, foreign intelligence services will go into your laptop the minute you leave it in your hotel room. They'll go to it and at customs checks points. You're never safe as long as your information's in the clear. Like I say, he could have gotten pretty rich, but he wanted to be very rich, and so he went to the dark side. This was in 2004 when he was 30. He moved to Manila, where he could bribe a lot of people. He set up an e-commerce pharmaceutical sales venture, which involved a lot of websites that say Canadian pharmacy and American doctors, all of which are lies. And you could buy Viagra, Propecia, sleeping pills, things like that, pictures of American-looking doctors, American-looking nurses, lovers, for sex aids, things like that. But all of that was offshore. It was in Manila, and it was in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. He made hundreds of millions of dollars, or he brought in $300 million just selling prescription drugs offline.
So he made $300 million just selling drugs online. What happened next?
Well, that was in about 2004, 2008 or 9, it turned out that Americans particularly have a huge appetite for all kinds of pills. And I attribute that to very aggressive advertising by the drug companies. When you open up any magazine, you'll see a lot of ads, including my ads in Time magazine, where I worked for 20 years. And it looks all pristine and clean and harmless and beneficial. So people trusted his websites. They didn't want to go to the doctor for some reason, and they'd gotten more pills than the doctor would give them, and they just signed up with him. But in 08, 09, Congress passed a law that said that FedEx and Visa and Google and all of these online services of various kinds had to be more discriminating, because a young man had died of getting some drugs online without a prescription. It was called the Ryan Height Act. Paul LaRue realized he should diversify, that he wasn't always going to be safe, particularly in the Philippines, because sometimes the Philippines is friendly to the U.S. and sometimes it is not. He decided to diversify into the arms trade. He knew that people around the world, rich people who wanted their own private security services, individuals, guerrilla groups, warlords, small governments in Africa and Asia, they all wanted a lot of small arms, and they didn't necessarily want to buy them legally. They just wanted to buy them. There's a huge trade in small arms around the world. No one knows how big it is, but it's billions and billions of dollars. He decided that would be a good thing for him to go into, and so he started building an arms sales platform. He went to the U.S. to see if he could buy guns here, because he knew that it was pretty famous that you can buy guns here. And he could, but the long guns that required a lot of paperwork to export, so he ruled that out. He went to Indonesia, and he bought a shipment of guns to see how that worked. He sent emissaries, let me put it that way. That got caught, and somebody tipped off the authorities in the Philippines, and he got labeled as a gun runner, or actually his organization did. He paid money to keep his own name out of the papers there. That didn't work out, so it occurred to him that what he needed to do was to make a deal with Iran, because Iran makes very good small weapons, infantry weapons. Iran is not influenced by the U.S. government. To the contrary, he could probably buy as many as he wanted. He also tried China through the organized crime groups known as the Chinese Triads, and that looked promising as well. But when he sent his emissaries to Iran to make a deal, they negotiated for a while. The Iranians didn't make an instant deal, but when they did, they said, yeah, we can sell you this stuff. Here's our catalog. He was very excited by that. But we want something from you. We're under all these sanctions. We need certain components of electronics gizmos that we can't get on the open market because of the sanctions. These turned out to be, some of them, components for nuclear devices. That's what it looks like to me. They never said exactly why they wanted them, but they're having covered nuclear proliferation, I know the names of certain components that you need to make a bomb or to make a missile that the bomb will fit on, and you can shoot it up in the air and hit something. The most interesting request was that they needed a better navigation system for their small rockets and missiles. Iran has given about 150,000 small rockets and missiles to Hezbollah, the militant group, which is Shia, like Iran, but is based in Lebanon and is fighting in Syria on behalf of the Assad government. Quite regularly, Hezbollah bombards Israel with small rockets. They rarely hurt anything or kill anybody because they don't have any navigation, so they go up, they fall down on sand, wherever they fall, gravity. If they could guide them into buildings, they could change the face of Israel. They could destroy buildings. They could destroy parts of the Israeli Defense Forces. They could destroy water systems, communication systems. It would change the game in the Middle East. If that started to happen, Israel knows that Iran gives Hezbollah weapons and gives Hamas weapons and other anti-Israel terrorist groups. So Israel would strike back, certainly at the terrorist camps, and that's happening now. If you look at what's happening in Syria and Lebanon, Israel is attacking encampments and also factories where Iran has set up rocket factories in Syria. If Israel strikes back more ferociously, you get a widening war. The U.S. gets drawn in, maybe not with troops on the ground, but certainly with money, and the NATO alliance is drawn in, because if the whole region starts going up in flames. This is very, very important. LaRue was going to help Iran and its proxies have a far greater capacity to wreak havoc in a strategic part of the world. What's curious about this is he had call centers and businesses in Israel, and yet he was willing to see them bombarded just because he enjoyed the mischief, the evil of a widening war and civilian casualties. he kept going. He was also trading in gold. He was trading in timber, African timber. He is from Rhodesia, colonial Rhodesia, which doesn't exist on the map anymore. He grew up in South Africa. He's a racist. Not the most violent racist in the world, but he said used terrible names for people of color and considered them less than human. He called them marginals. He said the same thing about Filipinos. If they died, he said, well, they're just marginal. They don't matter. He kept going until he started killing his own workers because he'd get paranoid and decide they were stealing from him. He threatened one particular man who was a European, former Navy diver. He liked to hire ex-military men. He hired a lot of mercenaries to as enforcers. This particular guy, we call him Jack. That's what LaRue called him. He wasn't an enforcer, but he was a builder. He had run a building company in Europe. He was building a base for LaRue in Somalia, which was going to be like an Amazon for arms. It was going to have a landing strip that could accommodate cargo airplanes, a port that could accommodate cargo ships, tenders, everything you see in a regular port. He was had barracks, he had arsenals, he had guard towers, he had he was even going to have livestock and a desalinization plant on the coast of Somalia so that it would be entirely self-sustaining and virtually invisible, because intelligence agencies really don't pay any attention to the desert in Somalia. He had paid off the pirates, the Somali pirates, to let him land his ships full of arms, and from there he was going to deliver arms to everywhere in the world. Jack, the builder, got tired of being threatened by LaRue. And one day LaRue told him to, when he had some men wounded by Al-Shabaab terrorists, LaRue just said, well, bury him in the desert. You mean bury him alive? Yeah, well, maybe. So Jack took off, and he tipped off the CIA. He put a tip in the CIA tip line, his name, his real name, and his real phone number, and he went to another part of the world to live. CIA didn't do anything about that, but they saved the information. So a year later, when these two DEA agents found out about LaRue in a roundabout way, they went looking for somebody who knew the inside of his organization and who could help penetrate it. The CIA shared this name and number. The DEA agents went to meet Jack and convinced him to go back into the organization, get close to LaRue, and help lure him to a place where he could be arrested.
What an incredible ride through this story. How did you get brought in to this story?
Well, I pushed very hard. Nobody ever hands you anything in this life, not if you're a journalist. Or if they do, you got to be very, very suspicious. Because chances are it might not be even slightly true, but sometimes it is. And I pushed. I wanted to know about this. This story, at that point, it was 2013, LaRue had been arrested, and he was in the process of luring his henchmen. He had agreed in exchange for some consideration, maybe, he would help bring in the hitmen that he had hired, all of whom, or nearly all of whom, were military-trained snipers. The DEA agents were extremely anxious to wrap them up because they were trained killers and they were willing to kill for money, cold-blooded murder for money. So he had joined Team America, but from inside the prison. He was in a prison in New York. He had been taken there. He had confessed. He had pleaded guilty to certain crimes. He was awaiting sentencing and is still awaiting sentences, depending on how well he behaved and how much help he was. So I heard about this, and I got his name and a few other details, and I started talking to the people in the unit that brought him in. and was working on the other guys under him, and that's called the 960 Group. It's part of the Special Operations Division of the DEA. And I do what reporters do. You talk to one person, you talk to another person, you talk to another person. You piece together the story.
And you wind up with this with a story that reads like a novel, and I think that's one of the hallmarks of your work, is that it really is narrative nonfiction, that you take these events and these people and you weave a narrative that just engrosses us as readers. Are there any tricks that you've learned through doing this that help to look for the engaging pieces of the story that make the story a page turner?
Well, that's a good question. There are several. When I was at Newsweek and Time, we did what we call TikToks, which is in chronological order, set down what happened. I mean, that's another way of saying a timeline. And when you look at who did what when, in very rigorous order, you see how one event causes another, one decision causes another, and that timeline gives you some questions to ask. Did what happened in 2008? Why did he go from a white collar criminal to a more violent criminal, starting to hire hitmen to kill people?
Right. And from there, one question leads to the next question, and you discover the plot unfolding.
That's right. And you see it, in a way to tell it as a narrative, not by topic. You could tell this kind of story by topic: Iran, pharmaceutical drugs, hitmen. He also dealt with North Korea. I didn't even mention that. He decided to go to harder drugs, cocaine and meth. Meth is a huge drug of abuse in Southeast Asia and East Asia. It's a stimulant. It's a lot cheaper than cocaine, particularly in that part of the world. North Korea pumps out a lot of meth. He started buying it through the Chinese Triads, which is an organized crime group that basically organizes the rat line to get stuff out of North Korea and to sell for hard cash, then smuggle stuff back into North Korea that people with some money want. You can organize all of that by topic, but I wanted to tell a story in a way that was people could read and understand. I started working with Michael Mann. I mentioned he had done a miniseries on my earlier books, and we became friends. He's a very good writer, so when I told him what I was doing, he said, "Gee, I want to do that. I want to do that as a movie. Let me see what you've written." And I showed him, and he really loved it. So I started showing him takes. He never said, add this character, subtract that character, but he did say, "You know, I don't understand this paragraph. Maybe you could rewrite it." He helped me clarify and sometimes simplify to make it more understandable to the person who hasn't been buried in it. Because if you're a writer and you start getting buried in your topic, you want another pair of eyes to look at it fresh and say, "Well, you know, this part makes great sense, and I'm very excited about this part. This other part gets too detailed and murky, so you need to stretch it out a little bit, make it clearer."
Well, I know that working in prose in book format versus film, I mean, they're two totally different mediums. But other than having Michael to kind of bounce ideas off of and to look at things that could be clarified and that sort of thing, did thinking about how this would be portrayed on film, did that have any effect on the way you told the story?
Not for me, because I'm very stubborn in that I never want to write to a basically fictional medium. I mean, the when it's a film, it'll be inspired by true events. I want the true events to be absolutely pristine, just as they happen. I wanted all of the investigators, the agents, the prosecutors, other people involved in this case to say, this is absolutely accurate. I wanted them to stand behind me and say, this is what happened. I wanted the criminals, if I got to them, to say, this is what happened, and stand behind me. I didn't want people coming forward and saying, well, it wasn't really like that. And so I always made sure to run everything I was writing, I ran it by various sources. I didn't give them the manuscript, because you can't do that, but I'd call them and say, did this happen, did this happen? Do you know why that happened? I spent a lot of time. They gave me thousands of hours of their time, because we all had a goal of telling the story in the right way, because it's an important story. People need to know that there's a whole dark world out there with a lot of money sloshing around that's paying for a lot of violence, a lot of war, a lot of terrorism, a lot of misery, a lot of disruption of whole countries. People need to understand that. And as a journalist, what I try to do is get people to a story in a format that they can understand it and they can get their arms around it.
Well, this book definitely opened my eyes to an entire world that I didn't really know existed. And it gave me a new appreciation for the work that law enforcement does and the dirty, dirty job that we depend on them to do and don't even realize that we do. This is a book that reads like the best novel I've ever read. I absolutely love the book, Elaine. The book is called Hunting LaRue, the inside story of the DEA takedown of a criminal genius and his empire. It's on sale everywhere now. We've got links to it in the show notes. Elaine, if people are interested in your work and want to read more about you and maybe connect with you, is there a place online they could do that?
Yeah, I set up a little website with the help of my son's fiance. We've got a little mom and pop operation going here because we're not rich, but it's elaine-shannon.com. And if you come there, you can see a bit of biography about me. You can link to my other books. If you want to buy them, there's links there, and we're putting up stories about all the books as fast as we can get them up there.
Excellent. Well, we're going to send everybody to see you, Elaine. This book is tremendous. I'm recommending it to everyone. Elaine, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today and sharing your story with us.
It's very kind of you, and I particularly appreciate what you have said about law enforcement. There are men and women out there every day getting shot at and sometimes killed because they're trying to enforce the law. There are a few bad apples in that profession like any others, but most of them are just trying to get through the day and make all of us safer, and I don't like it when they are maligned.
Absolutely. And we love and appreciate the work that they do and the sacrifices that they make, 100%.
Yes, yep. Sir.
Elaine, thank you so much. We're going to send everybody to see you. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Very kind of you. Thanks.
Missing Wings by Andrea Luman. Born with an ability the Vilidi people of Madar believe make her one of the first to be blessed by God, Katrina's destiny unravels when her father is poisoned and her mother steals her into the human world to hide among those who hate her kind. In a near-fatal attempt to return home, Katrina is stripped of her wings. The poison meant to kill her father leaves him in a degenerative state. When her eldest brother discovers she has survived, he orders her to stay in hiding. She must wait, concealed in the human world, until the danger of their father's uncontrolled rages is contained. Grown and adapted to the human world, Katrina encounters one of her kind. The promise of home and the first love leads her into a situation capable of starting war among the Vilidi. Will a human upbringing, mistakes, and the loss of her abilities bar her from reclaiming her heritage? Will unraveling the mystery of her mother's betrayal lead her family into an even greater danger? Missing Wings by Andrea Luman. The Locust, books 1-3 by Ralph Kern. The complete Locust series, an epic tale of mystery, survival, exploration, intrigue, and war. The cruise ship, MS Atlantica, is lost. On these strange and uncharted seas, where even the compass shows the sun rising to the west, Atlantica's passengers and crew must do what it takes to survive. In Unfathomed, Atlantica arrives in a strange new world. Unable to locate land with no way to contact home, they must find new allies, fend off relentless enemies, and discover the horrifying truth behind the Locust. The future of humanity will be decided as the fleet confronts the architect of the Locust. Not everyone will survive the desperate final battle. The Locust box set contains all three action-packed novels in this best-selling science fiction thriller series, Unfathomed, Expedition, and Osiris. Acclaimed for great characters, thrilling action, technical accuracy, and a compelling sense of mystery. Buy it today! The Complete Locust Series by Ralph Kern. Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Welcome to historic Sleepy Hollow, settled in 1640. Jason had looped around the town and had come up Broadway from the south. Behind the retaining wall next to the sign, a yard worker turned on his leaf blower, sending a tidal wave of yellow and red up and over the stones to splash off the windshield of the RV. They passed antique shops, a Shell station, and a Food King grocery.
"This is the same Broadway, you know," said Eliza. "It goes all the way down to Times Square. Used to be an Indian trail, Manhattan to Fort Orange, for the fur trapping business."
She kissed the dog.
"Oh, don't worry, baby. Nobody's going to skin you. And you know what the town's most famous for?"
"Well, duh," Jason said. Every kid named Crane, especially one as tall and skinny as Jason, had heard a lifetime of Ichabod jokes. He hoped never to hear another.
"Did you know it was a real place?"
"Of course," he said, though he hadn't.
"Don't be so smart," said Eliza. "Turn here."
The streets sloped towards the Hudson, the hillside trying to shake the village off its back. Jason slipped in behind a UPS truck and drove upwards. They turned onto Gory Brook Road. He stuck his head out the window, trying to pass. The UPS truck turned aside to the right. And he saw the house.
"Here! Here! Here!" said Eliza.
She pointed at the driveway of 417 Gory Brook. Jason brought the RV to a smoke-belching halt. The house stood on a knoll, above a steep yard that angled downwards toward the Hudson. An ancient sycamore on the front lawn leaned precariously. The roof was an irregular A-frame, with a long slope on the left and a short one on the right, like a rotated checkmark. The upper floors were trimmed with bands of chocolate-brown wood in a rectangular pattern. They made the house look as if it were trapped behind the bars of a jail cell. A tiny triangular portico extended over the front door, which was rough-hewn, rounded on top, held together by two vertical metal bands, and dotted with nail heads. A Gothic novel in Braille. The gray-blue curtains at the ground floor bay window gave the place a veiled eye aspect, like his grandmother's cataracts. The house seemed to be inspecting Jason with that eye.
"What are you doing here, boy?" "I'm watching you."
Eliza put a hand on his shoulder. He jumped.
"This is it," she said.
She slapped the dashboard. "This is what?"
"Our new home."
"But..." Jason turned to her, baffled. Her face sparkled with delight.
"Surprise!"